This is the third in a series on the ministry of the laity. What we have been doing this week is trying to share with people a number of different aspects of the ministry of all people of God in the world. We've said that in our baptism we have been called into ministry and that our ministry is in the world. We're using the term ministry of the laity because too frequently the term lay ministry conjures up people serving in the congregation as lectors or ushers or assisting in some way or another in the congregational life. That is a part of the ministry of laity. But what we are talking about is helping lay people to claim their ministry in the totality of their lives. And the way we've been working at it this week is by using the pronouncement that Jesus made of his ministry in the fourth chapter of Luke. This was the period after he had been baptized, was in the wilderness, had come out of the wilderness, and began to engage in his ministry. He was in the temple and was given the scroll of the prophet Isaiah to read, and he read from the 61st, what we call 61st chapter of Isaiah. This is a section that describes the new Jerusalem, the new way, the new world. And this is what he read. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. He has sent me to announce good news to the poor, to proclaim release for prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to let the broken victims go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And we were taking those particular sections of his pronouncement, referring again to Isaiah, and trying to interpret them in terms of what that would mean for us in our ministry in the world today. This evening, we're on this part that says, "Proclaim release for prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind." Now, sometimes it helps to look at this in terms of the way different versions of Bible translations handle that section. The King James Version says, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to preach deliverance. Both the Revised Standard Version and Phillips say to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind. New English Bible, to proclaim release for prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind. The Jerusalem Bible, which is the one I like in this particular instance, is to proclaim liberty to captives and to the blind new sight. Now it's interesting that in the Isaiah section in the Old Testament, the latter part, that is recovery of sight to the blind, is not there. What we find in the Old Testament section of Isaiah is to proclaim liberty to captives, freedom to those in prison. Or a New English Bible, to proclaim liberty to captives and release to those in prison. Now, we could be talking this evening about prison ministries in terms of literally working with people in prison, which is certainly an important part of ministry of the laity. We could also be talking about the way in which we as Christians can proclaim release from the captives, people who are captive of their own fears and their own concerns, anxieties. I rub shoulders all the time with people who are very uptight, very anxious about their financial well-being, what the future will hold, people who are captives of their own fears, people who also are blinded to the total wonderful possibilities of life and live a very narrow kind of life. We could talk about how we can proclaim that kind of release. But the way we're going to get at this evening is to talk about a particular kind of captivity and blindness that we've been encountering as we work with lay people, and that is the need to proclaim liberty to women and to give our blind society a new sight. Judy and I have worked with lay people on lots of retreats. And the thing that is so discouraging to me, to us, is we go around and talk about what people do with their lives. So many women will start out by saying, "I'm just a. I'm just a housewife. I'm just a mother. I'm just this. I'm just that. Indicating a very negative image of their role in life. And we see such tremendous possibilities, potential for women in ministry, and we really think we've got to work on the whole business of helping women see their potential and helping society get a new vision of the role that women should be playing in society. So this evening, there's no better way to get at this than for Judy to be working on it, because this has been the contribution she's been making in terms of our working with lay people. So I'll turn it over to you here. Let me say one more thing.
All right.
That is, we've been married 32 years. And when we got married, it was the old traditional way in terms of roles. And we've seen our roles change as we've progressed. And I must say it hasn't been easy. But thanks to Judy, and thanks to three daughters that we have, I think I've got a little bit more vision, a little bit more sight. And I guess what I'm a little bit concerned about this evening is that, you know, here we are, and there are a lot less men here this evening than there usually are for this kind of sessions we've been having. And that says something.
Do I need to introduce myself?
Sure.
I'm Judy Deal. I think there's a double problem with women finding their ministry. You have to ask yourself three questions. How does a woman see herself? How does she find her identity? And then how does she find her ministry? And I think the double problems that women face in our society today are, number one, how she sees herself, and number two, how society views her. And so I've broken down my little talk into these two areas, and I will proceed from there. I've found that women tend to define themselves in terms of other people. When I started out in life, I was a daughter of somebody. I was a sister to six brothers and one sister. Then when I got married, I was a wife. Then I became a mother. I've been an aunt. I'm now a grandmother. When I became a wife, it says something very important, that I became Mrs. William E. Deal. Bill did not become Mrs. Judith Rue. And this says something immediately about where women are in terms of society and how she views herself. Then when you talk to women and you ask them, who are you? Tell me who you are in one sentence. Several years ago, I've played this game for several years now, and if I'm in a mixed group, the men almost invariably will say, I am manager of sales at Bethlehem Steel. The women will say, I am the mother of four children, I am Bill Deal's wife, and so forth. They will identify themselves by other people. I've noticed increasingly, though, that women are not doing this, so I'm very happy to see that. There's a growing awareness among women that they are people in their own right. In addition to that, women tend to say, I'm just a housewife. Then many women will say, I'm a homemaker. Now, this is one step above a housewife, because you're really not a wife to a house. And then a number of women will, they're not satisfied with that one either, so they will say they're domestic engineers. And I promoted myself right out of the house by calling myself a professional volunteer, which I was for many years. Now, a man not too long ago said that he felt that mothers of young children were prophets. And he said, For example, a mother says to a child, don't put your hand on the hot stove. You might burn yourself. He says, that's prophecy. And in reply to that, I said, I wish somebody had told me that when I had four young children and called me a prophet instead of a mother of small children. We'll move on to what a woman is worth. Sylvia Porter talks about dollars and cents of what a woman in the home, in unpaid work, what she's actually worth. And Sylvia Porter comes up with a figure of $18,375 a year if the husband would have to replace her with other help. Now I'll move on to how women are seen by others. I think that we start very early in life of indoctrinating our female children, and I'll speak from my own experience that I came from a family, there were seven boys and just two girls, and my father would have been very happy had he sent all the boys to college and not bothered with the two girls. But my mother insisted on it, and so we all went off to college. But meanwhile, in high school, the girls were constantly being channeled away from mathematics and away from serious subjects, and it was understood that maybe you would go off to college. But you were really going to college to catch a husband, and you would get married, and you would live happily ever after, and you would never work. And that's where I was coming from. The scene has changed considerably since then. However, the training still, I think, goes on. Then, when you move from that situation into marriage and small children, society sees the mother of small children, I hate to tell you how they see her. Let me get this out here. In the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which includes 21,741 occupations, this is put out by the United States government, I guess. I don't know who puts it out. Anyway. It is, the occupations are listed by skill complexity. This is listed as unskilled labor. Parking lot attendant, horse trainer, hotel clerk, dog pound attendant are equivalent or more complex than nursery school teacher, home health aide, foster mother, homemaker, and child care attendant, and custodians, which is really very damning for women. We will talk, let's see. As I said before, I wish somebody had said to me that I was a prophet when I had four small children in the home. The tendency of society, of course, is to view mothers of small children as non-working, also pretty much as servants, and the kids fall into this trap too. I remember when we had our kids were teenagers, our two older ones, Shelley reported back to me one day with great glee that she'd been visiting her good friend Liz, and this family, there were five children in it, and the mother prepared a meal for them, and they all wolfed down the meal, and then they rated the mother. Hey, Mom, that was a C-minus meal you just produced. And then everybody laughed. And I said to Shelley, don't you ever do that to me. I am not your servant. And that is a put-down of mothers. She'd never thought about it that way. But this is a constant conspiracy. This sort of thing goes on all the time. And then children, you know, when mothers fall into this trap of making a separate meal for everybody in the family, that's another put down of the mother as servant. We'll move on to women in community. When the woman is working, she works for less salary. I have some statistics on that one, too, which are very interesting. A working woman, in the Working Woman magazine, January 1980 edition, it says that in 1978, the first jobs of all women college graduates, the average earnings were $10,861 a year versus the first jobs for men at $17,891. The Kansas City Times asked the question, should nurses make less money than janitors? Should teachers make less money than garbage collectors? And then they go on in the Kansas City Times article. It says, a society with a conscience should look at equal pay for work of comparable worth, not equal pay for equal work, because that's very easy to get around. All you do is change the title. Not only do the women are women not paid equally, but also they tend to be in the jobs which are less skilled and at the low end of the salary scale and the low end of promotions also, by the way. And then, of course, this gets tied in with Social Security. So at the other end of the spectrum, when women are live longer than men, and they end up, the ones who have worked for less salary, so they end up with less Social Security. The ones who have not worked for a living and are dependent upon their husband's Social Security very often fare a little bit better. But if the husband had also had a pension, the pension disappears when the husband dies. So we have large, large numbers of women over 65 who are living way below the poverty level in this country. Then we run into how society sees women in terms of inheritance, in terms of divorce, law in general. There's a story about a woman in the state of Georgia. The law says that a woman's domicile is her husband's domicile. Now, translated, this is what happens. A young woman in Georgia, going to college in Georgia, decided she wanted to register to vote. But her husband had maintained a residence, his address. He was also a student. He had maintained his address in another state. So she was not allowed to register to vote because her domicile was her husband's domicile. So she went to court about this. She won her case, but the law is still sitting on Georgia's books. There are many inheritance laws which militate against women. There's some interesting ones here. I think you'll find these. This is a quote from, I don't have who said this, but anyway. The law does not consider any of the money that her husband has earned belongs to her unless he gives it to her, and it's then subject to gift tax, or unless she inherits it from him, and then she pays an inheritance tax. Now, this is from the Women's Lobby Incorporated. I didn't know where I picked it up. Okay. Of course, if he gives it to his church or any charitable institution, they don't pay a penny, not a penny. Here's a quote from Mrs. Martha Lewis from Wisconsin, a leader of the farm wife movement. A man works out in the field, and the labor that he does is evidence that the farm is his. A woman works hard on the farm, and it's called a labor of love. And here's another one. Francis Hill, associate professor of government at the University of Texas. Under current estate tax laws, a farmer does not pay an estate tax on common property if his wife dies, but a widow must pay. So those are a few problems of inheritance tax, of inheritance. Then we move on to, I've just sort of picked some areas, community areas, and the one that I've been particularly interested in is politics. I have a few stories about that one. Society tends to say now that it's okay to put women on school boards because they surely know something about children, but they're still a little reluctant to put them in places of more with more authority, even though school boards generally control more money than local governments do. For some reason or other, that doesn't quite sink through. When I was running for county commissioner, I was going to be interviewed by a local television station. So I went there about a half an hour early, and I was given a sheet of questions to fill out so that the man who was interviewing me would have a little bit of information about me, and he could ask me some intelligent questions. So on the sheet, it said, what party are you running? What office are you running for? What is your party? Name of wife. Then it went on to say community organizations do you belong to, civic organizations like Kiwanis, Rotary, etc. And I kept going through this questionnaire and got to the end of it, and there was no place on that questionnaire for the most important qualification that I had for the job, and that was that I had been elected to a government study commission. And I had served on the Government Study Commission. I had helped to write the constitution for the new government. And this was my big, important qualification. But there was no place on this questionnaire for this bit of information. Another story. I served on the Government Study Commission. There were 5 women. There were 6 men. And 2 of the women, and myself included, were coming out of League of Women Voters. And we had spent a lot of time studying the issue of this of a new form of government for the county. We had done a lot of homework on it. The League of Women Voters, you know, if any of you belong to it, you know how thorough they are. So Bernadette and I started to come out with ideas about doing things, and invariably, if she or I would open our mouths, we were either given verbal pats on the head or we were ignored. It was as if we hadn't said a word, as if, you know, everybody sort of went right by us. So after commiserating with each other for several months, we decided that we were getting absolutely nowhere. So what we would have to do would be to find another solution. We said, okay, who are our allies on the Government Study Commission? And we decided that the chairman and the assistant chairman were the people that would be our allies. And so we started taking them out to breakfast. And we would say, what do you think of this idea? Good. What do you think of that idea? Okay, fine. They would introduce the ideas, and the whole group would say, isn't that a good idea? So, okay, I'll move on. We have a real problem with language, how people see women. And I've got a whole long sheet, and I'm sure everybody in the room has an equal number that I've got. I'll just give you a few things. We talk about gainful employment, and we're never talking about women in the home. If you're talking about employment, you're talking and gainful employment. To me, that's a put down of women who are working in the home. Age gives character to a man's face but ruins a woman. You like that one? How many women over 55 are called distinguished or experienced? And what does it conjure up if you say it? How does it sound to say, my brother married a newsman, my mother is a salesman? And in case you think that generic pronouns are actually generic, that gives you a sample that they really are not. When I was elected commissioner, everybody immediately said, do I call you Madam Commissioner? I said, no, you don't call me Madam Commissioner. I'm Commissioner. Commissioner Deal. Women nag. Men are very careful about details. We talk about the priesthood of all believers, but you know we do have priestesses, so we're really not talking about everybody. We're talking about only men. And what does it mean when you say you're acting or thinking like a man, or you're acting or thinking like a woman? I have a whole list here of how to tell a businessman from a businesswoman. I'll give you a couple of them. He follows through, she doesn't know when to quit. He isn't afraid to say what he thinks, she's mouthy. He exercises authority diligently, she's power mad, and so forth. Okay, I have some really horrendous put-downs that are funny, but they're awful, and I'd like to share them with you. I have to find them here. Dr. Johnson, the famous Dr. Johnson, said, some women should be struck regularly like gongs. He also said, sir, a woman's preaching is like a dog's walking on its hind legs. It is not done well, but you are surprised to find it done at all. Here are some more. A wife isn't a jug. She won't crack if you beat her a few times. That's a Russian proverb. A woman, a spaniel, a walnut tree, the more you beat them, the better they be. That's an old English proverb. Woman is a domesticated wild animal, lecherous and sinful from birth, who must be subdued with a stick and guided by the reins of religion. And that was said in 1961, believe it or not, by a man named Octavio Paz. Here's another Russian proverb. I thought I saw two people, but it was only a man and his wife. In an article in Christianity and Crisis called The Trivialization of Women, by Carter Hayward and Suzanne Hyatt. They talk about trivialization, and I think what they have to say is sort of interesting. We diminish her power to reduce her importance, this is women in general, for we should like, with a shrug of the shoulder, to dispense with her should she prove difficult. They say the trivialization of women is a psychological tool by which men have sculpted models of normalcy on the basis of gender. The masculine model is the rational, orderly head and leader. The feminine model, the emotional, chaotic, submissive heart, which follows and supports. Culturally, the trivialization of women means that women's role is not only a supportive one, but also a private one. The male is the public figure, the female, and all she represents must remain private, able to move beyond the home only with her husband's consent. So. Now we'll move on to the church. What does the Bible really say about women? And I will be quoting from Dr. Foster McCurley, who is an Old Testament theologian at Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia. He talks about Genesis 1:26, of course, and the creation story is Genesis 2:18. In Genesis 1:26, he talks about, so God created man in his own image, male and female, he created them. You all know that very well. But he makes the point that Adham, A-D-H-A-M, means humankind. It is non-generic. It is translated generally as mankind, but it is really humankind. And we fall into this trap of saying that mankind is generic when it really truly isn't. And then in Genesis 2:18, although he talks about Eve being created out of Adam's rib, the word for God creating a helpmate or helper for Adam, the Hebrew word for helper or helpmate means equal, means counterpart. And where it is used in other places in the Old Testament, this particular Hebrew word, it is always God who is the helper. God as the basis of strength and wholeness. God is the helper. That says a lot about who Eve is. And then in the Old Testament, there are a lot of references, but Hosea 11:1-11, God appears as a female, as a mother. God teaches the child to walk, heals tender wounds, feeds the hungry infant. And then in Numbers 11:12, God conceives this people, brings them forth, carries them in the bosom as a nurse carries a suckling child. There are verbs and adjectives which are feminine, referring to God. The Spirit of God is feminine. The wisdom of God is a feminine word. Pardon me. And then on to the New Testament. Philippians affirms, Philippians 4:2 affirms two women as co-workers. In Romans 16:1, Phoebe is called a diaconess and a rostasis. And the King James Version couldn't believe their that the translators of the King James couldn't believe their senses, so they translated diaconess as servant instead of minister, and succorer instead of ruler for rostasis, because no way could a woman be a minister and a ruler. Also New Testament, Paul is forever being cited as anti-female, and I have real problems with him, as all of you women I'm sure do. But the one thing that he said was that I think is really important, there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And this, of course, is the transcending the law of Moses, the boundary line between Jews and Greeks, the boundary line between slave and free, and finally the most primary division of God's creation is overcome, that between male and female. So I think that when Paul is talking about women be silent in the temple and keep your heads covered, et cetera, and obey your husbands, he is following the Jewish law rather than the Christian transcendence of the laws of Moses. That gives you a little bit of an idea of what the Bible is saying and really saying. We talk about female clergy and bishops, which Dorothy Erwin has discovered She teaches at the College of St. Catherine in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she has discovered that in many old frescoes and prints, there were women bishops and women priests, and later copies of these works have turned all of these people into males. That's something rather new. She's doing a study on that. What are we doing in our churches, our congregations, I guess I should say? What are we doing with women? How are we dealing with the problem? I think that it should be pointed out that we have increasing numbers of divorced women who are heads of households. We have increased numbers of single women who are either divorced or never married, who are career people. We have increased numbers of older women. I'm not excluding men in all of this, but I think that the church, the congregations have been so family-centered that we have not dealt with these very large problems of the changing lifestyles, the changing family, who is family, and we're not dealing with these problems in our congregation. How much time do I have? I'm running out of time.
Right, yeah. Discussion.
Okay. And let me see what else I want to do here. I guess to sum it all up, Foster McCurley made the point that he says our biases force us to make bad conclusions. And he said that as an Old Testament scholar, he always came at his study of the Old Testament with a male bias, which he's very ready to admit at this point. And he said, when I realized that I had this bias, and I start going back over the Old Testament with new eyes, he said, then I see a lot of things that should be different and are different. And he also made the statement that so much of what we, the way we deal with women is traditional. The Jews dealt with women traditionally. The woman was the property of the man. And we still treat women in this country as property. Children and imbeciles is English common law. And women are treated as children and imbeciles. And he said, we really have to start getting rid of some of this tradition, or looking at the tradition. And he said, where justice is at stake, the issue becomes a matter of the gospel, and tradition has to be reformed. He said, we've got to go back to the gospel where there's a question of justice. So I will end there.
One of the things that we were doing in our congregation was having a series of forums on what we call Ministry In series. The most recent one was on women in the roles of mother and housemaker, whatever kind of professions they were in, and so on. The thing that impressed me in that series that we had, and we may want to talk about this, is a consistent feeling of guilt and anger on the part of a lot of women. Those women who were mothers and were in the home, most of them had a fair degree of education. They were feeling guilty that they weren't using their education better. They were tending little kids, and the whole society was glamorizing women out there working. So they felt a little guilty about that. The women who were working were feeling guilty because their children were home, and they felt guilty they weren't around to care for the children enough. And both cases, the women felt anger when we really got down to being honest with each other. They felt anger that their husbands really weren't sharing the load, that they were carrying a heavier part of the load of the homemaking and everything than their husbands were. And that was kind of a revealing thing, that this guilt and anger seemed to surface so much.
One of the gals said, When I go out or go to school, my husband babysits our children. When he goes out and does something, I stay home with my children.
So why don't we open up for discussion, take whatever you'd like to pick up.
What do you think about the new style of identity that in marriage the woman and the husband are joining their last names by hyphen? Like, I had a friend, Mary Stein, who married Brian Weber, and they became Mr. and Mrs. Stein Weber. And is that because...
I think it's a good idea. I have... My campaign treasurer and my campaign volunteer coordinator were man and wife, but one of them was Tom Morissette and the other one was Ann Peasley. And I spent more time explaining. I felt obligated to explain. And then after a while, I said, no, I'm not going to explain anymore. They are married. They are living together. They have chosen to, she has chosen to keep her maiden name. He has chosen not to force her to take his name. And so, if anybody wonders about it, let them wonder.
Well, I mean, this is the sense where they do write the names out right. Together.
I think it's a nice idea.
A little bit hard on the
children. One of my nephews has done this. He and his wife are, they have the hyphenated name.
That's very common in Germany and Switzerland. A lot of countries in Europe.
South America also.
South America, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
In America.
Mm-hmm.
What's not really the next generation?
A lot of them, what they do is, their kids, when they're married, they have a hyphenated name, both mother and father, and then the kids, at least in Switzerland, will take the father's name.
Or they can decide.
Yeah.
Or they make a decision which name they want to use.
I think in South America there's a more complicated way of taking parts of both names. I'm not sure, but it would be fun to find out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think it's much more of a, shall we say, holistic way of dealing with it.
It's a traditional pattern. Which
yeah.
one you take?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Judy, I was going to ask, this has nothing to do with names. I was going to ask if you've come across any movement afoot, writings that suggest what the Ninth Commandment does to women, because there it is, and especially the way the Lutherans count it and the Catholics count it, that that still has as a commandment women as the property of a man.
Seen this discussed at great length, although I've seen it mentioned in many, many articles to point out how the Bible writers were males, and they were writing for as they saw whatever they were hearing or whatever they were coming up with, they were filtering through the patriarchy.
Yeah, I was thinking that it's interesting that we've had a relatively new translation translation of Luther's catechism, the updating of the language. We've had a new hymnal where we've taken out sexist language, but nothing has been done to renumber those commandments so that we match other denominations, not Catholic and Lutheran, and a renumbering where you simply dropped off all the things that you covet or don't covet or whatever. Would solve a great difficulty there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know, then you're dealing with the whole problem of are we changing the Bible? I don't think we are, but...
That's a question that came up at the convention. You know,
did it?
Trying to, so there was some suggestion that we really rework the Bible to remove this, what would be considered sexist language. And of course, that's like rewriting history. That's the way the Bible was written. And I think we have to recognize that. George, if you'd want to respond.
I am, being male, I suppose I have to respond that way. But I go farther. I have difficulty in what people do with hymns, where they take old hymns. For example, John Bunyan's poem, He Who Would Valiant Be, which was written that way. And it's now they who would be pilgrims and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I really in favor using generic language contemporary hymns and so on, but it's kind of like rewriting Shakespeare. It bothers me.
Well, didn't Dr. Cummings say you mustn't tamper with the word of God? He got really kind of tremulo in his voice. And I thought, yay, Cummings, go, man.
I identify with all the things you said. And there was a day, maybe I should preface by saying that I have three children, the oldest is 15. And before the advent of my husband or those people, I was very enthusiastically engaged in earning a PhD in zoology. And I stopped 17 academic hours short of that in a paper. Spent years angry because I had been denied that, or at least the fulfillment where that was going to go. And took that out on my family in many ways, and on myself and on my husband. And probably would still be doing that if it had not been that Jesus became a person in my life, and not only my salvation for eternity, but the power of the Spirit within me that to love one another and servanthood became another meaning, not one that was bound by duty or force, but one love. And I thank God that I have received, at least in my life, the revelation of being set free in Jesus, that all of those arguments don't even make me anymore. I am amazed, you know, that I can say that to you, having been so mad about so many things for so long, and just have the knowledge and the Spirit living in me to set me free. And I know that all these problems of sexist language and salaries and all this still need to be worked on, and this inequality within society to be resolved. But Jesus did that in me, in my life, and I don't have a problem anymore. Thank you.
Certainly it's important to talk about these things, these injustices that have happened, are happening, and will happen. But I agree with you in that I kind of think the emphasis that was being placed on release to the captives, my interpretation, I'll say, is that regardless of what label people place on me or what status in my life I might be, it really doesn't matter. You know, when God releases me from any of those status kind of things, and I think you said it much better than I could ever say it, but I think that's what was trying to be communicated in what was read. Although what you said is very true and important to be discussed, I think that's really the essence of where it's at. Regardless of where I am, what I'm doing, who I am, what my status is, God has a ministry for me right there, and it's up to me, I guess, and God to find ourselves together and how we can make a contribution.
I guess you know, my response is I'm not sure it's an either or. I think we've got
think
to work
so
the whole thing. We have to work it out in our own situation, yes. But I think God does call us to justice. And as a father who saw three girls and one boy grow up, I look at the lives of those four children, and that boy had a lot more opportunity and freedom and culture than those three girls did. Our oldest daughter was an excellent pitcher, a little league pitcher. And when she grew up, they never had baseball for little kids, for little girls. She warmed up the team, and then when it came time to play, he played. You know, so she was bound, she was captive of the culture. I think we have to work for that in terms of our calling to for a justice.
Yeah, it isn't either or. It's because I think we're called to be right with God ourselves, but I think we are also called to work on injustice.
Well, I'd like to suggest that maybe it isn't either or, and that sin is involved, not in status, but in anything that thwarts the will of God and human beings. And if men in this society, as I believe men in this society today are doing, are thwarting women, that it's a sin, and not to cry out against it because I have freedom is a sin. not to cry out against injustice. And to be silent is to desecrate the blessing of Jesus Christ that is given us on the cross, and to make none effect of what Christ has done, and not to care about our sisters. So it may be that if we are silent or treated only as status, we may be sinning and crucifying our Lord again.